Down to Business with Bobby Kerr on News Talk.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Now we kick things off today, as is done every Saturday, by having a look at the business stories in this morning's papers. I'm delighted to be joined by Caroline Reedy. She's head of HR Solutions with NFP, and also Kieran Hancock, the business editor with the Irish Times. You're both very welcome to the programme. The front page of the paper of note, Kieran, Trump plans for another 10% global tariff. Breaking news yesterday evening. And just maybe to bring us a bit more up to speed on what's actually happening, I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Dan O'Brien. He's the chief economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs, and he's also a columnist with The Currency. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Bobby.
Good to talk to you, Dan. Okay, so what's happening here? Trump's, basically the US Supreme Court, in a 6-3 majority decision, has ruled that President Trump has exceeded his authority in imposing many of the tariffs announced over the past year. So, what happens now, and then what happens next?
Yeah, well, this is a big question, Bobby. It's not entirely clear. Let's say that this decision was anticipated. It's very, very clear that the president had exceeded his power. In the U.S. system, Parliament has the power to impose taxes, not the president. So this was well anticipated. It was also well anticipated by the administration itself. There have been numerous reports over many months that different things they had plans to impose alternative tariffs on different legal bases if this came about. So immediately, as we saw last night, President Trump announced that there'd be a 10% global tariff to replace the tariffs that have been struck down by the court. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has said that they will raise as much money from the new tariffs as they've already been raising. So there may be limited change in the shorter term. Over the longer term, it clearly is a defeat for the president in terms of the powers he has, or the powers he believes he has, to impose tariffs.
This all sounds very messy, Dan. What about firms now wanting to be reimbursed for tariffs that were supposedly illegal when they were charged?
It is massively messy. As you know, we're quite a litigious country here ourselves. Lawyers sue for many different reasons. In the US, it's even more the case. So there will be tens of thousands of American companies who've paid tariffs on the tariffs that were struck down that are now going to go to court and seek to get Uncle Sam to hand to write them a check and hand back their taxes. So it's a massive win for the lawyers, and it's going to be very messy for companies seeking to get money back.
And finally, Dan, $200 billion reportedly raised by tariffs for the US last year in 2025. $200 billion. It's a massive sum, and if some of that has to be paid, or all of that has to be paid back, God, what's that going to mean?
Well, it's certainly, like, in the broader scheme of things, with the U.S. economy being as big as it is, Bobby, I know it sounds like a lot of money, but it's not, you know, it's not a game changer amount of money given the size of the American federal budget. But it definitely does raise a question, given that the U.S. is running massive deficits, that it will make those deficits even bigger if it does, if the Treasury Secretary is wrong and it does lead to a bigger deficit. It will sort of rattle the bond market a bit even more and raise concerns over the financing of the U.S. government going into the future. So, you know, potentially implications there as well. Although I would stress, I really don't think it's going to have much of a short-term impact given the alternatives the administration has lined up to replace these tariffs.
Okay, Dan, thanks for your analysis as always. That's Dan O'Brien there, chief economist of the Institute of International and European Affairs, and a columnist also with The Currency. Kieran, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that makes an interesting point. Tariffs are, imports are only 10% of the US economy. So it is a small piece of the jigsaw, if you like, in terms of the American economy. There's a lot of questions still to be answered. And one of the big ones is, what does this mean for the US-EU trade deal that was struck in the wake of his Liberation Day tariffs? And that was to impose a 15% tariff more or less across the board, with some exclusions. So we'll have to wait and see. Yesterday, the European Union and the government here were sort of saying they were going to carefully look at the ruling and assess its impact and so forth. There was a small fear emerging yesterday from the EU side that one of the ways in which he might try to recoup this money is to go after certain sectors. So he's able to impose tariffs on certain sectors under what are called, I think it's 232 investigations. Yeah. This is aluminium, steel and so forth. He could also impose it on pharma,
yeah,
on pharmaceuticals. Now
That's the risk here, isn't it?
Yeah, he's chosen not to do so thus far, which is good for Ireland because we export a lot of pharmaceuticals to the United States and it would be a huge...
Yeah, and we'll talk about that level of exports in a minute. Caroline, can I bring you to the front page of today's Irish Mail? A whistleblower exposes hotel doubling prices for a Bon Jovi gig in Croke Park. This sounds like a despicable practice.
Indeed. So this is an alleged wrongdoing, I suppose, by the hotel who are denying it. But in this article, we're told that the Dublin One Hotel in Drumcondra, which is right next door to Croke Park, for the Bon Jovi concert, they didn't realise in the UK that this concert was going to be on. So they had priced the rooms lower. And when they did realise, this whistleblower is alleging that basically they said to customers that basically they had to re-enter their card details again within 24 hours because they weren't valid. The wrongdoing, I suppose, is alleged at this stage. But ultimately, if it is to be the case, it's really showing that exploitation. And I suppose it's also showing that the customer, like the respect for the customer, I suppose, fair enough if they wanted to use dynamic pricing, which most hotels do going forward. But I think the key to this allegation is that it was when they realised that Bon Jovi was on, they then retrospectively said to customers, your car details aren't valid.
Yeah, and I suppose to be, not to defend this, but I suppose they did give the people who had booked an option to secure their booking at the original price. Now, if they didn't choose to take that up, they went back to the market at multiple the value.
Yeah, I suppose one of the key things here, though, was they didn't need to pay for the room at the time. All they needed to do was put in their credit card. And in the article, we're told by one customer who said, I'm using the exact same credit card that I used before.
Right.
But now it's after going from 290 to a double room going to 800 yeah. euro for the night.
Like, this sort of stuff gives hotels a bad rap.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
This is an outlier here, Kieran.
Absolutely.
But it gives the hotel industry.
No, it does. It does. It reflects badly on the industry as a whole. So 35 of the 80 rooms, the people didn't update their details. And so they were faced with having to have a cancellation or having to pay, you know, an excessive amount of money for rooms that apparently they booked for €290 originally. It's not a good look. The hotel is denying it, as Caroline mentioned. And they're saying that room rates are dynamic and reflect market demand and all of that kind of stuff. But I think people can sort of see through that kind of comment.
Yeah. Never think you're smarter than the customer, isn't that it, Caroline?
Absolutely.
Now, I don't know if you've been following the travails of the royal family. There's a little piece here by Louise Walsh. The nicest thing I can say is he was an arrogant buffoon, referring to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. God, this is some saga, isn't it?
It is, and it's, I suppose, it's such a serious issue that, you know, I mean, so many people's lives so negatively impacted because of it. And this is now centering around what's the impact going to be on the royal family. But nobody has a good word to say about this gentleman. And this lady, Sheila Bailey, who was interviewed, has said that she met him twice a year for 12 years and that he was a ghastly man. And she compares him to having met the late Prince Philip and saying he was an extraordinary man. So I suppose I think everybody's trying to distance themselves dramatically and rightly so from Andrew Mountbatten Windsor now. But I suppose the court of public opinion is strongly, very much saying that this isn't acceptable. And yeah. I suppose the calling out of it is probably a little bit too late.
Kieran, the Reuters photograph there kind of says it all, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, he's in the back of the car. He looks startled. He looks exhausted. I mean, he faced, he was 11 hours in custody, apparently. It was a very high profile. Amazing how the photographers and the cameras and the drones and so on were in place when the police pulled up in their stream of vehicles.
Yeah.
On his 66th birthday. So, you know, there was kind of maximum publicity for this, but he's made his own bed, I'm afraid. And it's shocking what's happened. And the revelations that are coming out, it's extraordinary. And some of the photographs as well. I mean, you just wonder how a man who's so well educated, who had so much privilege, managed to walk himself into this.
Yeah, yeah. Caroline, we heard earlier in the week about the big three, the unnamed, but the speculation, I suppose, that, you know, three companies basically paid 46% of our corporation tax. We're looking at a piece here by Adrian Wechter about the Apple expansion, showing that mega billions tech boom in Ireland is far from all over. And we'll also look at an Eli Lilly story, but this is two of the three per se, which is really good news for Ireland.
Absolutely. And I suppose we know how dependent we are, you know, for that corporation tax with Apple, Microsoft, and Eli Lilly in that order. And obviously OpenAI is one that's added in here to say, you know, we're reassured that Apple obviously during the week is reassuring Ireland that it's still core to its future with its Dublin office opening and its revamp of its Cork office for its 6,000 employees. Similarly, OpenAI is doubling its headcount in Dublin, and Microsoft again is looking at expansion around the data centres, and they've 6,800 employees. I suppose there's two kind of key things to this. Ultimately, we know that the tariffs impact, you know, that's one of the close monitorings that everybody is keeping an eye on, because obviously if Trump had his way, they would be looking to go back to the US, which is what, you know, he's trying to achieve. But particularly the Eli Lilly piece, you know, it's obviously the amount of tax due to the new slimming drugs, you know, that have really, I suppose, increased their contribution.
They paid $2.2 billion last year.
Huge, you know.
That was 2024. Yeah. So they'll probably actually be paying more for last year because they exported a huge amount.
Because of the tariffs, they front-loaded.
The export of ingredients for these weight loss drugs, which have taken off, as we know.
So they shipped, Kieran, $42.3 billion.
Like, yeah, that's right. And
the numbers are huge.
Yeah, and they've more of these drugs coming on stream, including a needle-free oral weight loss pill, which will suit a lot of people who don't want to face needles. So that's probably going to grow.
Yeah,
that figure.
Yeah, no. As I say, if 40%, 6% of the tax take is there, and there's real positive news there for Ireland with two out of the three. What's not to like, as they say.
Absolutely. Good quality jobs.
The role of the directly elected mayor, workable, is it? What's happening in Limerick suggests not. Less than 2 years into his term as mayor, John Moran is feeling the pressure, Caroline.
He is indeed. So this is a 5-year term, which is usually rotated yearly between the main political party councillors, who are obviously losing out on the opportunity to get that, you know, opportunity to do that too. So I suppose it was a big deal in 2019 when the plebiscite, you know, elected Moran as the mayor for them in Limerick. And John Moran is, you know, really calling out the fact that ultimately they're prohibiting him from doing his job, and also the legislation needs to be modified to help him do his job as well. I suppose ultimately here, the job of all the councillors and the mayor is the best interests of Limerick and, you know, its people. Like, he has very ambitious plans and, you know, things like a train between Limerick and Shannon and modular housing,
etc. I think one of the problems is that he doesn't have the right to allocate resources, assign tasks, or assign budget. I think that possibly is the fundamental problem.
You're absolutely right. And there's a legislative review that was built into the legislation to happen in 2027. But he's asking for that to be done sooner because he's saying that that's operationally not effective. And I suppose this came to a crescendo where they were agreeing the the corporate plan, and basically he had to leave after 4 hours because he was unwell, but they went ahead and agreed it in his absence.
I'd say there was a lot of anger there, and again, I think he put it out in a blog. But, you know, it's like Arthur Kieran, you know, people need to get on in these things. If you've got a situation...
Yeah.
Now, one could also argue that the councillors who are sparring with him are also elected members.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, there's obviously a vagueness in the legislation which, you know, is creating these tensions and allowing councillors and the council, if you like, to bite back at some of what John Moran wants to implement. And John Moran, while he worked in the Department of Finance for a few years, he's not a traditional politician. He hasn't come to this party from the likes of Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael or Labour or Sinn Féin or whatever. He came as an independent candidate. Now, you have to say he absolutely wiped the floor with the rest of the field. You know, as an independent candidate, he got more than 18,300 first preference votes,
yeah.
Which is extraordinary in an election like this, and the people clearly wanted him. So that has to be respected. But you're right. You know, you have to build a consensus with people, and you have to, your agenda has to sort of fit with what they want as well.
Yeah.
I think he's failed to do that. And it probably calls into question whether, you know, this plan is going to be, this idea of a directly elected mayor is going to be rolled out into other cities.
Well, I think this was going to be looked at as a kind of a template. So clearly now people are looking at this and saying, for whatever reason, this isn't working.
For years, we've been talking about a directly elected Dublin mayor, maybe along the lines of what they have in London. But frankly, I don't see the government ever doing that because Dublin is such a big part of the economy. I don't see them handing over a huge responsibility for a big part of the economy to somebody who's directly elected.
Yeah. So as we said, the two issues are not in control of the budget and the money. And secondly, not being part of the political elite.
Absolutely.
In other words, if you're not Labour, Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, you know, we're agin you, as they say.
Yeah, well, they obviously lost out in the election, and they're certainly making life difficult for them at the moment, that's for sure.
I think probably they have to refocus now to go, listen, what are we all trying to achieve here? Because if they don't resolve it soon, they're not going to achieve anything, and Limerick and its people are going to be the ones losing out.
Yeah. Will adding a garden room or a home sauna increase the value and attraction of your home? Nice piece today in the Indo Money, Saoirse Hanley. Interesting enough, there's some debate as to whether a sauna adds any value to your house, but a well-built, you know, shomra or outside office, as long as it's well-built, could raise the value significantly.
Absolutely. I think one of the biggest things here is reminding people it's all about usable space now and maximising the space and making sure that it's well maintained, which is key to making it an attractive proposition. One of the interesting things as well, Saoirse Hanley highlighted, was with space restrictions, you know, personal preferences of the man cave or the really big children's playground, etc., might be, you know, prohibitive. They might be doing the opposite because the person looking to buy it may then say, okay, it's going to take a lot of effort here to remove or to change, etc. But I think ultimately it's so difficult to get a house at the moment. You know, can buyers really have a wish list versus the supply and the demand challenge? But without doubt, I think that office space, you know, the modular piece down the back is definitely, because of space restrictions, you know, highlighting that that is really the biggest.
And because so many people now work from home, we have a scenario that, you know, these kind of home offices, be they shomras or otherwise, they are obviously attracted to buyers.
Absolutely. And I know lots of people who have them and they're so well kitted out and they're so cozy and, you know, they love the fact that it means the separation from their house, you know, when they work. So I think definitely that is one of the key attractions.
Kieran, have you got a shomra?
I don't have a sauna at home, Bobby, no. And I can only, I'm sure you probably do. You could probably bring us up to date on how much it costs to maintain them. But I think we had some data out during the week from the CSO showing that the median house price in Dublin, that's, you know, the middle price, if you like, is now above €500,000. And those houses definitely don't have saunas or shomras or anything else out the back. So I think we're talking about a small segment of the market and the higher end of the market as well.
Yeah. It is interesting, though, because if you look at the proliferation of them now, Like, if you look across a, you know, a whole terrace of back gardens, and you'll see, you know, three or four where you ordinarily there would have been garden sheds with tools and garden implements and stuff. Now they've been reconverted. And there's a nice story there in Cantle and Caroline around working from home. What are the stats actually telling us?
So these CSO figures tell us the working from home trends, the sands are starting to shift. In other words, I suppose it was 15% pre-COVID, went to 44% during lockdown. And since the summer of 2022, it's been around 35%. But in the last quarter, in the first quarter of 2025 versus this year, there's 78,000 more people gone back to the office. And even though we still have 960,000 people working from home, which is three times more than COVID, it's definitely starting to see more and more that going back into the office, which is good news for the employers, possibly, who are looking for some more return, and for the coffee shops and
retailers,
you know, retailers and the property owners, you know, where space definitely has reduced in most cases, where the hot desking now is the common office scenario rather than everyone having their own individual space. But without doubt, employees are still favouring the wanting at least hybrid. And, you know, we're really seeing that. There's a WRC review. The government have done a review of the legislation around the right to request remote working. That's going to be out in March. So it'll be interesting to see, because at the moment, all you have as an employee is the right to request, and you've the employer has to go back. Like, I suppose what it means is, as an employee, you'll get a timely response, but that's all you really have.
It seems to be sort of tokenistic and almost, you know, frustrating that if you go and ask that, right, you've asked, and now the answer is no.
Yeah, I suppose as well, the balance though is we can't tell employers you need to facilitate everybody to work from home if they feel, for whatever reason, look, there's pros and cons. I suppose I've always had employees who work remotely, and I think employment is based on trust, and, you know, people will do their job and do it well. But ultimately, in some organisations, they want to physically have the people, and we're seeing more of that happening, especially customer facing, collaborative type organisations.
Yeah.
You know, so I think the 3-2 is definitely shifting to 3 days in the office and 2 days at home versus being the other way around maybe in the last 12 months.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on this, Kieran?
Yeah, well, if you read the piece carefully, it's saying it's too early to call the trend one way or the other. And it's also making the point that the figures for Q1 might actually start leaning the other way because of the bad weather, storms and all of that. People might have been working from home a bit more in January and February. So it's still up for debate. And the other interesting statistic that is that in absolute terms, nearly 960,000 people are still working from home, more than three times the pre-COVID number. So it's still a huge part of our everyday work life.
And I think, as we said, the genie's out of the bottle. Anybody who's had been fortunate enough, you know, to be able to work from home, at least some of the time, really never wants to go back.
Absolutely.
To 5 days in the office.
Absolutely.
If we're honest about it.
Totally. And I think people have built their lives around it. The other interesting thing in this article was the fact that professional services jobs have started to, they're down about 50,000. And basically the AI element of, you know, jobs, we're definitely seeing that happening where, you know, there's a bigger focus on, can the job be done more efficiently and replaced from an AI perspective, especially for the administrative back of house type of roles.
Kieran, the biggest story of the day, you know, undoubtedly, is this next one, because Woody is now a baldy. He's got a Friar Tuck look. Toy Story's cowboy reveals his thinning hair in trailer for the fifth film in the series. Now, as someone who's follically challenged as I am, I'm delighted to see this representation of Woody.
I didn't realise toys could age, but there you go. Clearly they can. And poor old Woody is the fifth film in the series. He's been on the go for 30 years. And as you say, he's got a ball patch, it seems, in the new series. They've released a trailer which shows this, and he's getting a bit of slagging from some of the other characters in the film. So poor old Woody.
All right. Well, listen, Caroline and Kieran, thanks for a great review of the papers. We'll talk to you soon.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 8. News Talk. Conversation that counts.